our challenge is to make sure that we're not being dismissive of our voters who do feel the impacts of the rising costs of living.
So I think as we have these conversations, you can't just say, hey, we did this or we did that or this is our policy. You have to see it in the context of what has the working class gone through in the last 40 or 50 years.
Hi and welcome everybody. My name is Maria Skura and I am policy fellow at Das Progressive Zentrum. You are listening to our podcast, Talking Progress. This podcast explores new ideas for social progress in Germany, Europe and transatlantic spaces. This is episode 3 of our series on the just transition of the industrial heartlands in the US and Germany. The middle class in the former industrial heartlands played a key role for the outcome of the 2024 US elections. Michigan and Pennsylvania, two former industrial hubs and key swing states, both shifted to the right and helped secure the victory for Donald Trump. In light of the recent geoeconomic shifts accelerated by the pandemic, global crises and conflicts, and the ongoing efforts to tackle the climate crisis, one group is facing particular challenges: the middle class in the former industrial heartlands across the US and Europe. What drove those voters in the US to lean Republican? What can progressives across the globe do to counter these trends in the future? How can a new industrial policy address the changing dynamics in global trade and tensions in foreign policy while recognizing the needs and concerns of the working people? What are the actual needs and concerns of those communities? And what do people actually think about the politics of the industrial heartlands? In the latest episode of Talking Progress, our transatlantic podcast, we asked these questions. These issues were also discussed at the session on foreign policy for the middle classes, new industrial policy in times of geoeconomic shift, at the Progressive Governance Summit in June 2024 in Berlin. The summit was organized by us, Das Progressive Zentrum, and our partners, to find answers to the recent struggles and provide guidance for progressive actors in North America and Europe on how to overcome them. To set the stage, Claire Ansley, director of the Project on Center-Left Renewal at the Progressive Policy Institute, provided important context by sharing the key findings of a comprehensive transatlantic opinion poll. Conducted in March 2024, this representative survey captured the voices of people in the US and Germany, shedding light on their biggest concerns, views on economic opportunities, and how they felt about past and present industrial policies shaping both nations.
First of all, I'm just going to present some headline findings, which haven't been released yet, but they are part of a project that PPI, the Progressive Policy Institute, based in the US, is doing jointly with DPZ. And it's on this crucial area of what are the policy and politics that we need for our, we called it industrial heartlands, but we know what we mean in our respective countries, but that's actually really at the core of many of our political challenges. But this new industrial policy has come to the fore of our economic policy, but it's not all been plain sailing. There are, in the States, we look across at the States' economic performance and we envy their economic performance, but it is not translating into support for Biden, as we will hear. So we want to find out a bit more about what our panelists think about that. Have we got the policy right? Is it the politics that aren't? Is it that we are impatient for change? So we're going to talk a bit about the sort of policy and politics there. And of course, in Germany too, we've seen a different overall economic performance, but we've seen regionally some areas where there have been a strong economic performance, but we're seeing support for this populist right, you know, the AfD over here. So we want to unpack some of that. We want to find out more about the solutions. So we are accepting of the premise, if you like, of insecurity. We have some answers. So this is very much about solutions, but we're finding some difficulties when we are in power in terms of implementing those. So I'm really looking forward to hearing what the panelists have to say to help us understand those challenges, but really to be in the space of what, as progressives, we do now. Just talking through these panel findings, so I'm not going to give you lots and lots of slides or information, but it's just to give you a bit of a flavour, is We asked a kind of representative sample in the US and Germany some kind of crucial questions, and I've got the privilege of introducing these findings, but really it's colleagues at DPZ, Paulina Fralick and Sandra Ruth, who are responsible really for doing all of the hard work, so my thanks to you both. So our key findings, so we asked about the areas that you would expect, and some of it resonate in the paper that you may have seen. Please don't worry about reading those, because it will be difficult for you to read. Actually, that will too. So I'm just going to give you the headline then, which is, surprise, surprise, we asked, what are your top concerns? An economy and cost of living, far and away in both countries, far and away, are the most critical issues for people. So economy and cost of living come most importantly. So if you look at the sort of that graph towards the end, that's economy and cost of living, followed by migration, higher concern in Germany than in the States, followed by climate change. So a couple of kind of conclusions for us. People do care about climate change. It is in and of itself an issue. But for them, top of mind, when they think of crisis, they're thinking of cost of living. I'm sure you found this in your own work too. We've also found that in Germany and in the States, people are really worried about the economic prospects for their country. So although the headline findings, particularly in the States, are encouraging, people are somewhat or very worried about their economic prospects. So it gives us this backup, if you like, that people have a material basis for their insecurity. And we'll talk a bit more about the non-material basis. Interestingly, we asked a bit more. So we dug a bit more into what are the policies. So what are some of the solutions? And similarly found that in the US and Germany, with quite different, I think, political cultures, preferences, histories, there's quite a lot of support for what you might consider kind of classic centre-left or social democratic responses, so particularly on protection of industry. So there's a lot of support for protection of industry. And if anything, people wanting to see more federal spending, if you like. Now, there's contradictions within all these things, so never ever take any of these poll headlines at first reading, because when you actually get to the, well, how do you pay for it, we come into some more difficulty. But there is, if you like, this dilemma, because we have continuing strong support for some of these quite sort of state-backed, social democrat-associated policy, but we're not seeing the parties poll that same support. So we're going to sort of talk about why that is, and it'd be great. We'll have some time for your views too. On climate change, I think, frustratingly, I feel often there's a kind of a climate change versus the economy or versus cost of living. Actually, and I've done a lot of polling with working class voters in the UK particularly, but also in the US, voters, they care about climate change. It's not just green supporters or people for whom that's their top issue. For working class voters too, it does absolutely come into their top concerns, but it doesn't beat economy and cost of living. But I think it's important to note that voters are bothered about climate change. They see it as part of the challenges, and we will see what they think on solutions too. One of the things that we found interesting, may or may not have the graph here, is where we've talked about what are the policies that you want to see to equip your country for the future. So thinking about the future, what's most important to you? One finding that we were quite surprised and perhaps encouraged by was that in both countries, and in the US, Trump and Biden supporters, such strong support for education, science and innovation. So there was real strong support for policies that would furnish people with a better education, but for science and innovation, these really future-facing policies. More so, there was some support for the green transformation, some support of establishment of new industries, but actually some of the things that we could be leading on and be seen to be leading on were supported. And then finally, we asked about the transatlantic partnership. So we've heard quite a lot about globalization, deglobalization, this inward-looking. I mean, I'm speaking for the UK, who took ourselves out of the European Union, so I'm here to give nobody any lectures about inward-looking or outward-looking. But some of the encouraging findings we found from the survey were that voters in the US and in Germany perceived each other as shared values and strategic allies. A little bit of the difference between the two, so Germans more likely to see this as a strategic relationship, are those in the States more likely to see that as a partnership of shared values? But nonetheless, people in both countries were positive about the relationship between, wanted to see that continue. We are not seeing this kind of universal retreat from the, you know, the world stage. There's been some excitement about. There's definitely a wanting that to continue. So strong support. Those two bars at the end are the ones that are about what do you see the relationship as, but. Crucially, there's quite a significant proportion in the US who didn't know, who didn't want to say what they thought about that question. So there are some questions, I think, there. So finally, just to sort of wrap up our sort of headlines findings. So similarly to the research that you've already had, we're talking about security in a multidimensional way. So there is absolutely an economic and material basis for it, but it is not the only insecurity that people are facing. That despite the electoral challenges that our parties are having, the centre-left positions, those that you think of as classically centre-left, do hold to continue to hold some support. I did mention actually that not just that climate change came up as an important issue, but that voters in both countries wanted to see more government action on climate change, not less. So some interesting findings there. And you know, this has come out in every survey, economy and cost of living being the most important concern for voters. So how can we have our solutions to be answers to the challenges they are facing in their everyday lives, rather than perhaps trading off the two between each other?
Building on these findings and bringing the voices of the industrial heartlands to the conversation, our panelists, Brentia Berry, political director of the U.S. Democratic National Committee, Franziska Brandner, Parliamentary State Secretary at the German Federal Ministry for Economic Affairs and Climate Action, Holger Mann, Social Democratic member of the German Parliament, and Tim Ryan, former Democratic Congressman from Ohio, discussed the future of industrial policy and the crucial role the progressives can play in shaping it. From crafting empowering narratives to creating a fair global trade arena, from securing the support of trade unions to convincing a diverse electorate to progressive policies. Listen in on their conversation to get a full picture.
Thank you for all of you being here. I just returned this morning from New York and met some of the colleagues in a room in D.C. like 2 days ago. So, and we exchanged exactly on these issues. So it's a pleasure to be in this joint space of grappling with the challenges. Yes, it certainly resonates. And I think we haven't, when it comes to how do we translate a geoeconomic policy into an industrial policy or an industrial policy into a geopolitical one, we have joint challenges. I think we haven't really found yet out how we can be protecting our industries without being protectionist. Mm. And without becoming nationalist and having that drive going in the wrong direction. I think that is one of the challenges we haven't really come to a good solution. A second one is how can we promote our industries in times of where, you know, others would like to cut funds and spending. We have that debate in Germany, but we will also have it in France with the Commission going into the budget. And I think, how we can link it to security and making it cheaper will come by time. We see it. I'm like, it lowers the cost, but it's not always immediate. So the benefits are delayed in time. And that's usually a problem for politics when you tell them it will become better. Mm-hmm. But right now, it's not immediately much cheaper. So I think there are these time questions. How do we overcome this? How can we make quicker wins in terms of cost of living? And then the other, which are more conceptual, how can we, what are tools of promotion that are not linked immediately to the budget? And do not go into too deeply detailed regulation, which is then the other side. If you don't have money, you go for regulation, which becomes very burdensome. So what is a good mix in between? And if you do it only via pricing, in the US you don't have it, in Europe we have it, we find that it undermines very quickly the narrative of cost of living, and then you're back into the circle. So I think these are the challenges we face. And the protectionist part is one that I really worry about, because I think that some take our spins and turn them one further, and then you're in a corner you don't want to be in.
Very interesting, and we could deep dive in, but I'm gonna go to each of the panelists first, and then we can deep into those questions. So I'm going to come to Holger, and then I'll be to Brent here next.
Okay, yeah. So last 3 years, we struggled through some crisis, the pandemic also already mentioned, the war of Russia against Ukraine, and the rising energy prices, and after that, the high inflation. And so the biggest topic of the people at this time and last vote was, of course, the increasing prices, and especially also in cities as mine, as my hometown Leipzig, which is swirling and growing, and in successor of transition in the last 10 years, was the topic of higher rents for housing. So, and I think the people are a little bit concerned about their future because of rising prices and uncertainty in economic progress. And so we have to take their concerns have to deal with, and give them hope that the transition, and especially the transition in energy market, they will benefit from. Mm-hmm. Because, for example, we had a special topic in Germany. It's called the Heizungsgesetz, a law for modernized heating. I think the only state in Europe who gives her inhabitants more than 20,000 euro for modernized their heating, but we lost this debate on populists. Mm-hmm. To the populist criticism.
Well, that has been a topic that's come up this week in my discussions. So I'd love to come back to environmental policy and how we can make it more related to cost of living. Yeah. Thank you both. Brentia.
Yes. I agree with everything that was said. For us, as you all know, President Biden, Vice President Harris are running for re-election, and we also have several key elections up and down the ticket for Democrats in order for us to maintain the progress that we have made under their leadership. But our challenge is to make sure that we're not being dismissive of our voters who do feel the impacts of the rising costs of living. And while our economy is in a strong position and we are showing incredible progress, it is challenging to say, okay, the president, you know, and with the help of Congressman Ryan, has passed some of the most pivotal legislation of our lifetime, investing in Americans, investing in higher wages, investing in job growth across the board, and your groceries are still expensive. And so making that connection, and also to your point about the longer term impacts when it comes to infrastructure, significant investments that this administration and Democrats have made. And a lot of those projects, shovels won't be in the ground until the next 4 years. So it's our job to continue telling that story about the investments and the real life impacts that voters have seen and will continue to see under Democrats.
Great, thank you. Tim?
I don't have a whole lot to add. I'm in complete agreement around the cost of living and expenses and rent, especially in the United States where that's a huge issue. Interest rates are high. The only thing I would really add is more contextual, and that is that for American workers, whether they're white or black or brown, men or women, manufacturing, retail, they have been traumatized for 40 years. So you know, this is not a snapshot in time. Why are they insecure right now? It's because even if you have a good job now in places like Ohio that I used to represent in the industrial belt, Youngstown between Cleveland and Pittsburgh, Even if you have a good job, you're looking over your shoulder because your dad lost his job and it was so traumatic and you've lost a few jobs. And maybe now you've latched on to a battery plant that's UAW, United Auto Workers, good wages, new contract. Even with all that, you're still looking over your shoulder. So I think as we have these conversations, you can't just say, hey, we did this or we did that or this is our policy. You have to see it in the context of what has the working class gone through in the last 40 or 50 years. And I'm 50 years old and the steel mills collapsed in Youngstown when I was six. So my entire adult life and people who are my age now working in a steel mill still think I'm doing okay, but, and I think it's important for all of us who are either making policy or trying to influence voters to vote one way or the other, need to keep that in mind, because that will give you not the keys to the kingdom, but I think it will unlock your mindset into how best to communicate what people are need and what they're going through.
Mm, great, thank you very much. I'm going to stick on policy first, and then we'll let's come back to the kind of politics of it. But I want to go to Francisca's point around the point that you touched on, which is really important in terms of protection and versus protectionism. The desire, the impetus from the public is that they want to feel protected. And if you feel, if we think about our theme of security, when you are fearful, yeah. You want to be protected and you feel safe. And there is a good story from the populace, which is, we'll keep you safe, because we'll keep those people out, because they're the problem. And we will, essentially, you know, as Trump instigated, it was that kind of disruption to the global order. Tell us more about your kind of concerns on the kind of policy of what that could do, where that might lead.
Yeah.
And what you would want to advocate for as we're thinking about a different form of, as Schultz said, he was pushing us to think about what's the form of capitalism, what's the model of capitalism that we want to push for.
Yeah, 2 points. Allow me to say what I find very interesting in the American debate right now, and it's linked to inflation, which is also big here. I mean, in the US, inflation started earlier, already 2021. Here it was a bit later, mainly started to shoot with the Ukraine war. But there are a few things you can do that you know will raise inflation. Interestingly, I find that Trump is running on inflation and all the measures he proposes will increase inflation. Yes. If you put on a tariff...
Welcome to America.
I know, but I find it incredible that this is not getting through. I'm like, he says he will put tariffs on all of the products. That usually raises inflation. He says we will stop migration, so you will have less offer on the American side inside the U.S. to produce those products. So increased demand, lower offer, you will increase inflation, and then you have the third part, he will cut spending, so you even take out money off the system, so you will have, in another part where people cannot afford. So I find it, I was in the US talking to now a lot of people, I'm like, this is so interesting that he's running on inflation, all his measures will be inflationary. Mm. And why do we not get this message across when it comes to policy? And it's the same probably in our country, and so that I've been grappling about, and I think we have to find a good answer to that. That's why I think, just to put tariffs, I'm like, they will hurt us. They will make people's lives more expensive. And we can't want that. If you look at those numbers, that cost of living is their number one priority. But we do not link it up to that protection, how do you protect without raising cost of living? Mm. And I think where we probably have to go more is to make this a new trade arena, which is more fair, which is not undercutting salaries or sustainable way of production. And I just got from a meeting, I don't know if any of you is aware, but I find this a fantastic initiative by New Zealand. It was of Jacinda Ardern. She started it, and it's 5 years ago, and they finalized the negotiations. It's Switzerland, Iceland, New Zealand, Liechtenstein, and a couple of more small countries. And they have now a new trade deal on environmental goods and eco-labeling and on phase out of fossil fuels. Mm. And I find this fantastic. They did this for 5 years. It's a very detailed trade agreement. And I think, you know, let's make that big. Let's make that a joint progressive trade arrangement where we say, this is exactly how we translate our values and this is how we recognize our standards, not just of the products, but of production. Mm-hmm. Because we don't have WTO standards on, you know, sustainable production. We have them on the product, but not on the way of producing them. And that is a big difficulty in our capitalist society. We don't have this. So they will present that next week, Monday, by the way. New Zealand is very happy to, they will present it. So that is what where I think I would like us to go, to say, okay, you know, this one hasn't worked because it has undercut middle classes and destroyed our climate. So we have to find new ways. And maybe we can get inspired by the small ones and make it big. Mm.
And Holger, I wanted to ask about your perspective on jobs. Like, how do we translate this industrial policy into jobs that work for the people in, you know, in your district, where in your area? Because part of what we're hearing is when the investment can come in, and that's a big part of the policy, is making sure that we get the kind of foreign direct investment that we want, the domestic investment that we want. It's not just state spending. How do we make sure that connects up with the needs in your place and the workforce that you have? Perhaps you could tell us a bit about your place.
Okay, so let's call my place Eastern Germany.
Yes, okay.
For instance, it's okay.
It's a big place.
Yeah, it's a big place. And I think we have to tell the stories of success. For example, in Leipzig now, the most Porsches were built. Nobody knows it, but it is so. Or BMW has doubled his production in the last 3 years to 600,000 vehicles. So that's a part of it. And it's a part of reindustrialization. After the fall of the wall, we had no industrial base and also now high wages. Now there are people who get high wages and can tell this the story of success, but only we have to secure that there are a minimum wage so that the people can pay their rent. That it's a part, and we have now a discussion again in Germany about the commission who says on which high the minimum wage should be, between at time a little over 12 euro and now should go over 14 euro, and it's also a part of, because insecurity will throw all more waters to the populists and their narrow solutions. So, other point, science and science infrastructure. We are very successful in granting and founding scientific institutes, and for example, two big centers now in the eastern parts of Germany, and they deal with, for example, with the new chemistry future, so circular industry. Or we have founded two agencies, so the so-called SPRINT, the Agency for Disruptive Innovation. Yeah, we both work on it with Franziska. Or the DATI, that should secure transfer from our really competitive high schools. And this could be nucleus of new success, reindustrialization, and also startups. And after that, I can say we already had some big towns who are competitive also in Germany, but it will take 10, maybe 15 more years to be so successful that everybody got his benefits from it.
Do you think, if we were to ask voters in your place, so Eastern Germany, so it's a you know, big area, what do they think the benefits of those investments are? So many of us have wanted a version of reindustrialization policy for a long time. We're starting to get it. So we're starting to get that. In there's always been redevelopment programs, but this is a different form with much, much more impetus. If you went to some of those voters in East Germany and said, what do you think of this new, you know, whether it's the Tesla plant, what have you, what would they be saying to you as a politician, and what do we need to listen to?
If I talk to the workers at BMW, for example, they are proud.
Yes.
And that's because after fall of the wall, the most workers lost their jobs, and there was a long period of unemployment, and we also couldn't afford enough jobs for the people there. sehr schön.
Qualifications
wouldn't demand further. So now there is a new crowd of workers, and we call them the new workers class in East Germany, and we need more of them. But nevertheless, there are many rural regions where aren't these successful big industries. And therefore, in Saxony, we invest two-thirds of all funds for structural change in scientific and educational institutions. And on most times, that will benefit the next generation,
yes.
But it's a way to deal with.
Yes. And I wonder if there's something, as I'm thinking about Rentier, when it was Biden who said it's not trickle down, was it bottom, middle out?
Middle out, not bottom up.
which I think spoke to those of us who are policy wonks.
Absolutely.
We understood that and liked that. But that sense of perhaps we need to be aware that the experience of this reindustrialization might within one place feel like it's trickle down again, whereas actually the trickle needs to hurry up a bit, turn the taps on, or whatever it is to help those benefits, be it the not just for the next generation, but so that adult workers and others start to see what the benefits are. Many of us have looked. We're inspired in many ways by the Inflation Reduction Act and the package of measures, obviously, that Biden put in, and the sums of spending that that are now, certainly not going to be possible in a UK context with the interest rates the way they are. But it made us think, is industrial policy enough? So partly our story is this takes time. We've had 30, 40 years of one story. Two or three years of a new story is too soon, perhaps, to expect. But I'm also thinking, yes, but what else might we need to be doing to make sure that this form of capital really benefits people? Is there a conversation in the States, or should there be, about what are the other levers, or what are the other economic policies we need to do so that the people that you're speaking to and will be in the run-up to November and beyond can start to say, yeah, I'm starting to feel the benefit. So what do we need to do beyond reindustrialization?
Well, I think that the points that Congressman Ryan made about trauma and the way that we talk about these investments with working families is key. So for us, what we're trying to focus on is pivoting from, yes, billions and billions of dollars invested, and it is transformational, but what does this mean for you and your families holistically? Whether it's healthcare, capping the cost of insulin at $35 for seniors, and the Republicans have made very clear that they would like to get rid of the Affordable Care Act. So those are all aspects that, like, point blank, we can point to. This will only increase prices. This will only increase the impacts of your family's access to what you need to survive. And how do we make the connection between, yes, we have made these investments into more jobs, higher paying jobs, but making sure that we're showing tangible examples of what those jobs will be and helping to educate people on connecting with those opportunities. And one of the greatest aspects of this administration and strengths that I see is that a lot of our labor unions will say that President Biden is the most pro-union president that they have worked with. And so that is why he has endorsements from the building trades, from the United Auto Workers, and so just overwhelming support from unions, because he is investing in good union-paying jobs. And so it's also working through the messengers. When we are partnering with our union partners, they are very much like, we're going to do member-to-member outreach because we can speak to our workers and their issues in ways that you all can support, but we know our members. They want to hear about pensions. They want to hear about wages. They want to hear about the issues that are impacting them. So to me, that is also a tactic and strategy that we are really leaning on is the messengers that work daily with our various our coalition, which is big and diverse. Mm-hmm. And there are leaders in that coalition that have the authority and are able to make that connection directly in communities that sometimes this big government entity, the billions of dollars, that the economic talks might not make that direct connection. And so just amplifying those voices.
Yeah, indeed. Tim, on that topic, you talked about the way a family would feel, how a working class person feels, like there's the material, but there's also the psychologically, but people's places and communities are a part of that story. What could we do better as a centre left to connect up our big ideas with the experience that people have in their place? And is there a future politics for us which is much more connected to people's place? Tell us your thoughts.
Yeah, I think just to build on what was just said, I think the union piece is really key, because you got to remember, in America, it's five states that are going to decide the election, sad as that may be. And three of them are industrial states with strong unions. And the unions have been educating their members on do you support this issue, reindustrialization, infrastructure, CHIPS Act, the things that we were able to accomplish, and President Biden and Vice President Harris were able to accomplish. And they educate them on that. And then 3-4 months before the election, okay, which of these two candidates supported these issues that support us? So it's a good strategy to communicate. So I think that's good. I personally believe that on one issue point, I think we have to talk about energy and in a very realistic way. There have been projections of the energy demand in the United States. The increase has now projected to double because of data centers, because of AI and the amount of energy used for AI, and because of the reindustrialization. So I think we need to have a real pragmatic and honest conversation around things like natural gas. That has America led the world in carbon reduction from 2005 to 19 because our natural gas displaced coal. And so we have the ability to do that around the world and solve a major problem here in Europe. That's an issue piece. From a broader messaging piece, I think, and I've thought about this for months and months and months now, we have to become, Democrats in the U.S. and Social Democrats here, whomever, the party of reform. We have to be seen. There's no trust between the average voter and leaders, politicians. The trust is eroded. And unless you're in the Donald Trump cult, which you have blind faith. But for most people, there's no trust. And so how do you reestablish that trust? You become the party of reform. You become the party of, after 40 years, we're finally reshoring chip manufacturing from Asia to Columbus, Ohio. After all these years, we finally took on the drug companies and got insulin to $35 for Medicare recipients, and we want to do it for everybody. You look at the Affordable Care Act that President Obama did. That was a major reform, but we don't talk about it like that. Sometimes as Democrats, we're out having cocktails, we lament that we talk about the 10-point policy plan, which is bullshit. Nobody knows what those policy plans are. We need a major reset of the party. And I think us becoming the party of reform, us taking on the big pharma, us, taking on the global economy and trying to reshore, understanding the complexities of making sure that we're not shutting ourselves off to the world. Those are the making sure we're taking care of workers, making sure we're saving pensions. If you wrap that, I think, in a broader reform agenda, now you're the party, the scrappy Democratic Party that people used to remember, full of workers, full of immigrants, full of minority groups. That's the Bobby Kennedy coalition that didn't last very long because of his campaign. But Bobby Kennedy could go to the black area of Indianapolis or he could go to the white rural area of Indiana, and he would receive the same support. And when you watched his train go from, you know, down the East Coast, there were black folks on one side and white folks on the other side. That's the Democratic coalition. But he was a reformer. You know, we have to be able to, and you struck a chord here, I'm getting a little fired up.
Oh, I like it. But
yes. we have to, and I think we have to have this conversation too. It's so binary in the United States. So the Republicans will say, we're going to cut. We're going to cut Medicare. We're going to cut this. We're going to cut spending for that. And Democrats, we say, well, don't cut this and don't cut that. But I think where the space is, where the juice is in the middle for us to really pull people in is to say, we know we're spending a lot of money on this. And we know a lot of it doesn't get the results that we want. We spend hundreds of billions of dollars on education, but yet we have a huge skills gap, right? We have a lot of people that we need educated, but we talk more about college and student loans than we do about apprenticeships and getting people into the skilled trades. We spend 2.5 times more than any other industrialized country on healthcare, and we get the worst results.
Yes.
You know, we spend tons of money on all kinds of different things, and we have deaths of despair that are up, overdoses are up, addictions up, fentanyl's up, suicides are up. We're doing something really wrong. We're spending the money. So I just don't want Democrats to get caught in this trap of like the one polling question said, should we spend more money on?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, maybe, but I think we would have a lot more credibility going to voters if we said, here's our reforms. Here's what we want to do. We're going to focus on prevention. We recognize how the big industrial food companies have poisoned our people, poisoned our kids, you know, selling them junk, fake food. We're going to take them on, and we're going to reform that system because our kids deserve to be healthy. And if they're not healthy, they can't be educated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, we're not just going to throw money at problems, although we may need to spend more here or there, because we also have deficits that we have to worry about. But the reform mantle, I think, in my heart, that if we can grab that mantle, and whether it's here or in Europe, grab that mantle of reform, because you're going to connect with people on that emotional, traumatized level.
Yeah.
If you're traumatized, you don't want someone just telling you your 10-point policy plan. Mm-hmm. You want to find out, and Trump says they're screwing you, and they're like, okay, I'm traumatized, I'm going to go after who Trump says is screwing me. Or we can say, they're screwing you, but we're the reform party. He's all talk, and he didn't do anything when he was in, and we're the reform. If we become the reform party, you know, like a Teddy Roosevelt progressive back in the day, I think the Democrats can have a long runway with having a lot of success in our political system back home.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you. Yeah, and well, thank you if you're selling that I'm buying. I think part of what you touched on there, and we've spoken about this, is the kind of the emotion that we need to connect with as well, that actually industrial policy is really important, and we all think it's important. We wouldn't have flown over here or been part of this if we didn't think it mattered and was part of the solution. But what problem is it the solution to? It's a means to a particular end. And I think what you're describing there, Tim, is kind of what that kind of mobilizing vehicle could be, which makes me wonder about where great climate policy fits in, not just good climate policy, but great climate policy. So how do we engage and mobilize great policies on the environment? Because it matters hugely. It's part of the insecurity people feel. We know that. But we could probably all have another panel on the ways we think it's communicated about, which make people actually more frightened and less likely to feel like it can be part of a reformist program. Perhaps if I can, I'm a bit mean, but I was going to start with Holger and perhaps go to Francisca on given your experiences here on kind of the heating policy in particular. How can we make great environmental policies the answers to people's problems? Could it be part of this reform agenda?
Mm-hmm.
Yes is the answer. Yeah. No.
Which way is yes? Is what I'm looking for.
I already mentioned that I think that we must to communicate our successes and what the benefits the voters get from transition of the energy production. For example, the conservative in Germany now aim for nuclear power plants again. Mm-hmm. In my home country, in Saxony. And last year, first time, we produced more than a half of the electricity from renewable. So, and the prices at time are at the same level before the Ukraine war. So we got success, but we don't communicate that as much as we need it, I think. And that would be the question, especially because there are these concerns about inflation. If the people believe us that our reform agenda we already had in the traffic light coalition in Germany, that it will be successful. I don't think that we... Sorry, there I get another opinion in Germany. Maybe it's because of the German angst, the famous one. But I don't think that our reform agenda or communication now can be we need more reforms. The last vote says us, the people are a little bit tired of more reforms and more transition, and we have to communicate what we already done and after that because of what we will go further.
Yeah. Thank you. Francesca.
I very much agree with Holger's last point. I think in we have been communicating, we will reform, we will change, and people are like, no, thank you. you know, and we have been communicating in order to be secure and to be in as good place as we were in the past, we need to change. And people are like, we don't believe you. So I think, you know, the mistake was that we're like everybody sort of knows that you can't continue like this with the climate and there are like tides and there's, you know, so sort of, you know, it's not going the right direction. But I think the message to tell them, OK, then we will reform. They're like, So I think what we rather have to communicate is there will be change and we will guarantee you security in this process of change. And I think that for us is, at least in Germany, I don't know how it's in the US, it's a, you know, the message is rather, you know, there will be change inevitably, but we will make sure you're safe. And bringing that to the question of energy, it was very interesting because I think at one point we managed as a coalition to communicate that fossil prices can be very volatile. Like we felt it back home very heavily. And that if you have the energy here, you know, you're less dependent on outside volatility and make it cheaper for your own citizens. And right now we have in Germany this debate where the conservatives are going back to the fossil car and they love the fossil car. And at the same time you have this war in the Middle East and you have no idea how it will continue. And people are telling them, oh, you know, it's so much better to be dependent on this petrol oil coming from the Middle East, which is such a good place to be dependent on. And I think, you know, we need to tell more the story. Like, if you want to be dependent on this, okay, this is the conservative way. We create your car driving on the energy we have. It will be cheap for, you know, and stable. And I think that's sort of more the communication, saying this is a stable, cheap way of your mobility. You can go for the fossil one. Good luck. And I think, you know, we need to find more examples of that where we create that security and also in the transformation. And I agree with you on the better spending. I really agree with you on that one. Because if we only focusing on more spending, we will also be lost at one point. Because, you know, you have to focus on how you make it more effective and more efficient. And I think there we are often not good enough yet. I think what the Inflation Reduction Act has done very well, we rarely talk about it in Germany at least, I don't know how it's in the US, is how you linked it to training and skills. Mm-hmm. I think that was very smart. Yes. And we in Germany have a tendency to have a funding for technology X, funding for technology Y, and then we have funding for training, and then we have funding for yet another purpose. So for every single purpose, we have a spending program, which is very bureaucratic because it has a very narrow objective. Instead of saying, you know, there's a bunch of money take it to modernize new technologies and also train people. You know, so I think we have to get much better at that. And this is a, you know, I'm looking at you at UN budget, and we have a very silo budget negotiations, which often doesn't really help. You have those who are doing the training part, the others are doing the energy part. And I think the Inflation Reduction Act really managed to bring those issues together. And that's what I wish we could learn from a bit from the US for our better spending on how to make this possible. And a good note, maybe, because you were mentioning the energy needs of our data centers. I met, we have a German chips in this manufacturer, Infineon. And they're now working with DOE and DOD in the US because they have the most energy efficient chips. And, you know, these are success stories. And we have been pushing them in Germany. You have to be energy efficient, etc. And now they get the very good contracts because if you send them out in a weapon system or in space, they need to be energy efficient. So, you know, I think we really also need to communicate on these transatlantic, where you make your country safer because you have energy efficient chips from Germany.
Very good. Very good.
I like
great
plug. From Germany.
Yes.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Talking Progress. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and got a glimpse into the progressive strategies for a future-oriented industrial policy. Stay tuned for more conversations that matter. Till next time.